probably one of the scariest books. Not scary in the sense that it's scary, but we often don't want to go there because that's a lot of stuff that I might not understand. Revelation. All right. Okay. Okay. I wasn't thinking of Revelation. Take two. Think of another book like that. Daniel? Okay, that's Old Testament, and that is often, I'm not sure about that. Let's go somewhere else, okay? Hebrews, okay? I was so encouraged a number of years ago because, well, I went through Sunday school in Mexico through the book of Hebrews. Why does Hebrews scare us? If you're going to teach through Hebrews, it really scares you. Why does Hebrews scare you? What part of Hebrews makes you, Who said something?
Six.
Why six? Eileen? Okay, it's got some pretty serious warnings for believers about apostasy. Good. Dan, did you?
Well, there's phrases in there like, you know, them, if they've been enlightened, then they've fallen away. So there's a lot of wondering about.
Okay, well, anybody here who's taught through it in Sunday school? Coach, what's scary about Hebrews? All right, we don't come from a Jewish background. So a lot of those things just are so foreign to us. If we were of the Old Testament people, before of the Old Covenant, we would come to worship and we would bring animals and there would be slitting of throats and blood pouring and priests overseeing and all of those things. And then you come even further into Hebrews, and if you turn with me to Hebrews chapter 5, we do have that guy that Coach mentioned. He's got this name that, what's his name? Melchizedek. Okay, who in the world is Melchizedek? You ever read through Hebrews and say, oh, there's that guy Melchizedek, let's kind of get through this, because I don't understand that. All right, that's what I was referring to as a little bit scary. And when I taught through the book of Hebrews in our Sunday school in Mexico, I just kind of took forever to get to Melchizedek. Just kind of kept drawing that out because here comes that guy. We're going to have to deal with him. We're going through the book. But really, I want to just take a little bit of time tonight to read through some of these passages. And we're not going to go deeply, of course, but I want us to see if we can understand a little bit about this man named Melchizedek. He is first found, we'll start in chapter 5, verse 1. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God. All right, so a priest represents who? People before God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward. Go back to our study in Sunday school about pride. We've talked about leadership. These priests were to deal how? Gently with the ignorant and the wayward. Why? Since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself. No one ever in the Old Covenant woke up in the morning and said, you know, I kind of like to be a priest. They didn't do that. No one takes this for themselves, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. Who was the first priest? Aaron. Who were the priests after Aaron? His sons. All right, what tribe were they from? The tribe of Levi. So if you were from the tribe of Zebulun, you couldn't get up in the morning and say, you know, I want to be a priest. No, it was those who were from Aaron, who was called by God, just as Aaron was. Verse 5, so also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Who said that? God? His Father. Okay? And that's found, that's a reference way back in Psalm chapter 2. Psalm 2. And as he says also in another place, you, my son, Christ, are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So there he is mentioned. He's brought to introduction there. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who believe in him. Whoa, it doesn't say that. What does it say? Obey. So the author of Hebrews taught a work salvation. Yes or no? What was he teaching? Obedience. All right, I think what we can safely say is that faith is so closely tied to obedience in the scriptures. People who truly believe do what? Obey. People who truly obey, why do they obey? Because they're believing, okay? Often, belief and obedience are just tied hand in hand, all right? Where are we? I'm sorry. To all who obey him. Verse 10, being designated by God a high priest after the order of, and there he is again, Melchizedek. Now, verse 11, about this we have much to say, and it is hard to explain. It's good to know that the author of Hebrews thought the same thing. It's hard to explain. And he said, since you have become dull of hearing, I'm not going to say that to you tonight, all right? That's what this man said. But for though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the basic principles. So he goes on and he kind of leaves. He introduced Melchizedek, got back to him. And then he goes on all through chapter 6 and he talks about the warning against apostasy. Then he's talking there about why he can't talk about Melchizedek. And then he gets back to Melchizedek in verses 19 and 20 of chapter 6. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain. What is that referring to? The Holy of Holies, where only the high priest could go, but once a year, and not without blood. And so that is talking about Christ there, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. There he is again. Well, chapter 7, verse 1, he finally gets, and if you have a title above verse 1, what does it say in your Bible? Or a chapter division or a section division, what does it say there? The priestly order of Melchizedek. So he's going to explain what is this order of Melchizedek. You think of the Catholic Church and the priests that they have. They have different orders. What are some of the different orders in the Catholic Church of priests? Some of you who maybe have a Catholic background. Mark? Well, bishops or cardinals, okay. Those are designations of what those men do. Different hierarchy, different people in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. They have a Benedictine order, Jesuit order, Dominican order, Franciscan order. Martin Luther, I believe, was an Augustinian monk. Okay, so you have different orders there. And here we have one that's not mentioned. The order of Melchizedek. Am I correct? Do I remember right that the Mormon Church talks about the order of Melchizedek? Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I would say that they are way off base. All right, they talk about it, but it has nothing to do with biblical, with a real biblical reference. Okay, so let's read, what is this priestly order of Melchizedek? Aaron was from the Levitical order of priests. Okay, and here is another man, Melchizedek. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, first of all, where do we first read about Melchizedek? Genesis 14. Anybody know what happened back there? Abraham came back from fighting the different kings. He had gone off to fight them because they had taken off Lot and all of his family and all of his possessions. And so Abraham went to fight them. He beat them. And that's where Melchizedek first appeared. He was a real man, all right? This Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings. Priest of the Most High God. Where did he come from? Salem. Jerusalem. I'm not sure, but I believe it has something to do there with Jerusalem. I didn't get that far into this little study for tonight. But where did he come from? He just showed up. But he was a priest of the Most High God. He met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. So Abraham gave Melchizedek, this priest of the Most High God, what? A tithe. He is first, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness. All right, he was known as King of Righteousness. And then he is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. So two designations for Melchizedek, King of Righteousness, King of Peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy. Did he not have a father or mother? Sure he did. Why does it say he's without father or mother or genealogy? Because it wasn't recorded. We don't know anything about him. We don't know where he came from. He just showed up. There's no recorded history about his genealogy. Having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. What other kinds of priesthoods were there when Melchizedek showed up to give tithes to Abraham? Was there another priesthood? When was the Levitical priesthood established? 400 years later. All right, so this is way before the Levitical priesthood. Now, verse 4, see how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers. All right, 400 years later, God instituted the law and said, the priests come from the tribe of Levi. And the way that you are to subsist and to live is you are to take a tithe of all the people who are your brothers in Israel. Okay? Remember, they didn't have a possession in the land. They had different cities in every tribe. And anybody know what the total of that tithe was? Those tithes? It wasn't just 10%. If you add up the tithes that the Israelite people were required to pay, it comes to about a total of 23%. It wasn't just a 10%. There were different tithes for different things, and it was about a total of 23%. Though these also, it says at the end of verse 5, are descended from Abraham. But this man, Melchizedek, who does not have his descent from them, received tithes from Abraham, and blessed him who had the promises. What promises are those? Promises given to Abraham. God would make him a great nation. Those are found in Genesis chapter 12. Now, verse 7. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. All right, when there is a blessing that goes on, the one who is superior blesses the inferior. So who blessed who? Well, verse 8. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who was coming, not 400 years later, but 100 years later, 150 years later, perhaps, Levi himself, Abraham was Levi's great-grandfather, some kind of grandfather, all right? One might even say that Levi himself, who was still to come, receives tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. Who blessed who in this case? Melchizedek blessed Abraham. The inferior is blessed by the superior. Who is superior? Melchizedek. He blessed Abraham. Okay, verse 11. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? All right, gets back to the law. The Levitical priesthood, through Aaron, through Levi, came, and it kept on going. But if that would have been perfect, there would never have been a need for a priest after a different order. Verse 12, for when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. For the one of whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe. All right? Ultimately, this is speaking. If you look above verse 11, do you have another title change? Jesus compared to Melchizedek. Okay, now we're getting into what's really important here. And it described who was Melchizedek. Now, why is this important? The one of whom these things are spoken, Jesus, belonged to another tribe from which no one has ever served at the altar. What tribe does Jesus come from? Judah. What tribe do the priests come from? Levi. Any other priests come from Judah? Who was coming from Judah? Kings. Kings and priests had different functions. Priests from Levi, kings from Judah. Verse 14, for it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah. And in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. Moses never ever said anything about priests coming from the tribe of Judah. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent. All right, if a guy from Zebulun said, I want to be a priest, could he be a priest? What was the simple test for that guy? What's your last name? Where do you come from? You're from Zebulun? No, of course you can't be a priest. And here comes a priest, not on the basis of the legal requirement, you have to come from Levi, concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. Well, how indestructible was Christ's life? Didn't he die? Jim, you talked about that tonight. What? He is eternal, but he died. Somebody said it. He rose again. He is indestructible life. He is God. All right, verse 17. For it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Does anybody know where that comes from? Psalm 110. You'll find that there. For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness. Wow. That's kind of strong words to say about the law, isn't it? It was set aside because it was weak and it was useless, is what the word says there. For the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. Through which we draw near to God. How many Israelites could go and draw near to God in that tabernacle and later in the temple? How many? One. He could draw near to God. And he says here, the author of Hebrews says, we draw near to God. Do you see a benefit that we have today under the new covenant that they did not have? What is that benefit? Jim? We, all of us tonight, can come and approach God through this priest who is after the order, not of Aaron, not of Levi, but of the order of Melchizedek. Verse 20. And it was not without an oath. For those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath. You didn't need an oath or a promise to become a priest. I promise to do my job in this temple or this tabernacle. There was no oath necessary. But this one, who is this one? Christ was made a priest with an oath by the one who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever." This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant, of a better promise. Verse 23. The former priests were many in number. There were a bunch. How many priests do you think of the former priests existed? Six? 12? 20? What? The former priests were many in number. All right, just think of the high priests. During your lifetime, if you were a Jew under the old covenant, how many high priests might you possibly know? Three, depending on longevity of life. Maybe you could go through six, okay? I don't know. That's just a guess. But that's just in one lifetime. It's possible that you, during your lifetime, there was only one. But throughout the history of Israel, there were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. There were term limits on the high priestly position. What were the term limits? Death. You die, we need a new priest, a new high priest. But he, Christ, holds his priesthood permanently because he continues. Not like those priests from the tribe of Levi, but after the order of Melchizedek, this one continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Think of John 17. Jesus prayed that prayer on this earth the night before he was crucified. And now he is in heaven, and what is he doing? He's doing the same thing. He's praying. He's interceding for those. He always lives to make intercession for them. 26, for it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. How could he do that once for all by offering up himself? Eileen? Because he is an infinite God. That's right. So you think of, you go up in the Latin American Tower in downtown Mexico City and you just look out and you can count easily, just close, probably 30 or 40 or perhaps 50 Catholic churches, just from there. Not to mention all the other ones all around Mexico City. And every time there is a Mass, when that bell rings, the official teaching is that Christ comes down and inhabits the host and the wine, and that becomes his body and his blood. And why is that wrong? Because he has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. 28. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests. But the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. And we're going to read the first part of at least chapter 8. Now, what do you have as a title above chapter 8? Jesus, High Priest of a Better Covenant. Now the point in what we are saying, okay, he even tells you, here's the point. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. All right, the priest is the go-between between God and man. And a priest has to have something to offer. What did this priest have to offer? His own life, his own blood, himself. So he is the priest. He is the sacrifice. Those priests that offered day after day never offered themselves. They had to offer for themselves. Our great high priest is the one who offered himself. Verse 4, and now if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. Why wouldn't he be a priest at all? Got the wrong last name. It's from the wrong tribe. They, verse 5, serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, the tabernacle, he was instructed by God, saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. And so everything shown Moses on the mountain pointed to the tribe of Levi. You've got to follow this pattern. Verse 6, but as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, without any problems, if it had been perfect, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them, with the first promises of the first covenant, when he says, now, what is he going to say and what follows? Anybody have an idea? I'm going to make a new covenant. But is this new here? Anybody know where that was prophesied in the Old Testament? Jeremiah? And? Ezekiel. Is that what you... Okay, Jeremiah and Ezekiel. We find the promise of the new covenant back there. So he says, listen, all of these things had to end because there would not have been promise of, if there wouldn't have been a, there was a promise of a new covenant, and that just showed you that the old covenant wasn't sufficient. It wasn't good enough. So he found fault with the old promises when he said in the Old Testament, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel. Did God owe Israel a new covenant? Did God owe Israel a new covenant? No. What did God owe Israel? The wages of sin, which are death. And so God said, I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. Now that covenant was a conditional covenant. Do this, and if you do this, you will, if you obey everything in the covenant, you will live. All right? The condition was obedience. Did anyone obey? Not one. So, not like the covenant that I made with them, for they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant, verse 10, that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, declares the Lord. Now notice, this covenant is not conditional. What is an unconditional covenant? It didn't depend on, who didn't it depend on in this case? Judah and Israel. You have been unfaithful. And because you have been unfaithful, I am going to make a new covenant. Not like that old one. But in this new covenant, what am I going to do? I will put my laws into their minds. And I will write them on their hearts. And I will be their God. And they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord. There will be no evangelism. Why not? Because they all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. What does obsolete mean? Outdated. All right, let's say you made a will in 1999. And in the year... And you left everything to your, let's see, a good thing would be your oldest son. That's me, right? Yeah. A good thing would be your oldest son. And in 2004, you had a falling out with your oldest son. And so you said, I am going to leave everything to my youngest son. And then you die. And at your death, oldest son goes and says, look, I have a will. And however those things work, the probate judge says, your will is obsolete. Doesn't count at all. Well, could I get 50%? Obsolete. Doesn't count at all. Why is that testament obsolete? It's been replaced by something else. Now, there might be some aspects in that first will that applied to me that my parents said, okay, he's still going to get this, but now everything goes over here. There might be some things that are still active because they were repeated. But in this case, that first will, what I have in my hand is obsolete. And it says, what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. And so that is why we're here tonight, and we didn't bring animals. And we don't have an altar on which to offer animals. Because that first covenant is obsolete. And with the new covenant, which was established by Jesus Christ, who is after the order of Melchizedek, that new covenant is what is in effect today. When did that new covenant start? At the cross, a little bit before the cross. At the Lord's Supper, the first time that Jesus instituted the Last Supper. And we have come tonight, and we are going to partake of communion. And we remember this blood is the new covenant in my blood. And that is why we're here tonight without animals, and we remember what Jesus Christ did. All of those Jewish people looking forward offered sacrifices that prefigured Christ. We look back and we offer no sacrifice because there was a perfect sacrifice offered one time forever. And it was offered by Christ. And that established his new covenant. And we are partakers in that this evening.